Our guest today is Libby Whitmore. Libby began her acting career in the 1990s in feature films and television. From 2000 to 2006, she owned her own critically acclaimed nightclub, Libby's Cabaret. After taking a six-year hiatus, Libby came back to acting, where she appeared in Lifetime television movies such as The Pregnancy Pact, Queen Size, and the award-winning feature film, The Blind Side. Okay, today we have the beautiful, talented, amazing Libby with us. Libby has been my friend now for 5 years.
Yeah, I think so.
Has it been about that long?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and in that time, I've come to find how incredibly talented Libby actually is. She has so many hidden talents that I'm sure I don't even know about all of them.
We don't want to talk about them. That's why they're hidden.
I will allow Libby to introduce herself. So Libby, tell us a little about your background.
Hello, I'm Libby Whitmore. And my background is a lot of different stuff. It's musical theater, film and television, cabaret, one woman show type things. And I've been doing it pretty much since the dawn of time. I'm old.
But you're beautiful. You're very beautiful. You don't look a day over 30.
Oh, bless your heart. Nice to know those bribes are paying off.
So tell us how you were introduced to acting.
Well, it sort of came through music in high school, actually, when I joined the chorus, the choral department. And we did two or three musicals a year, you know, book musicals. Mm-hmm. We did, and a lot of musicals that were kind of out there for a high school to do. I mean, we did Cabaret.
Okay.
We did Company. We did, yeah. So that was sort of my beginning. So the beginning of my professional career was musical theater. And I was doing a musical in the summer of 1975.
Okay.
Which was after I graduated high school.
Okay.
And there were some auditions happening in town for a new dinner theater that was going to open up. And I didn't know anything about it, but turns out one of the musical directors came to see the show because he had read about it in the paper. And then he came to me and he said, "Do you have a demo reel?" I said, "No." He said, "Get one." So I put like two or three songs on it and sent it up to Maryland, which is where the home office was of this dinner theater. And then they called me, and in October of 75, I was hired by the Harlequin Dinner Theater and stayed with them until like 1977.
Had the acting bug by then.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, because at that point, I thought, you know, stage was what I was going to be doing. Yeah, that was the only thing I really foresaw, because certainly, you know, my dream or my idea was I need to go to New York.
Right.
Because I was thinking.
Absolutely.
Theater, you know, so I did that. And after I did the Harlequin Dinner Theater, then I got another job at a cabaret in town. And then for like the entire decade of the 80s, I did my one-woman shows in a wonderful room that was called Upstairs at Gene and Gabe's. And so I was there for the entire decade of the 80s. But then cabaret sort of died out.
Let's back up. Tell me, how did you get into doing one-woman shows? Where did that come about?
That came about they just called me and I was kind of known around town for doing these other cabarets.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy that owned Upstairs at Gene and Gabe's, he said, "I want you to come up and do a show with this other woman." And so like she did the first act and I did the second act. And then after that, from then on, it was just me doing my own shows, which at first were written by a dear friend of mine, mm-hmm. who is a wonderful writer, Tom Edwards. And so I would pick the music, and then he would write the script. And after doing that for a while, he moved to LA. And so I just started writing my own shows and picking my own music. And during that time in the 80s, a show that Tom had written called Della's Diner.
Uh-huh.
He wrote that, and he wrote a new one in like 1982.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow it got noticed by some people in New York. And so they wanted to take it to New York.
Okay.
But also at the same time, a woman who was an agent in LA, but was originally from Atlanta, which is where all of this, I guess I didn't mention that all of this is taking place in Atlanta. And she said, we're going to take the show out to LA and you're going to perform the show on the set of Alice, because it was a diner. And all these TV people are going to be there. So Fred Silverman and all these who back in the 80s were really big in television.
My acting teacher actually played Fred Silverman on Lucy Moves to NBC.
Oh, I think I think I saw you say that.
Yeah,
played so that was, Fred Silverman. And so that was very surreal. And of course, we were all young and thought we were going to be big fat stars.
Right.
And of course, none of that happened. But the gal who brought us out there, Judy Shane, who is no longer alive, bless her heart, she said, look, come out to LA and I'll get you on a TV show like that.
So did she become your agent?
When I was out there, yeah, for like the first 2 years. But, you know, I'm one of those types where I'm not, you know, the glamour girl.
Mm-hmm.
And in LA, that's kind of when you were my age, which was in my mid-20s,
mm-hmm.
they're not a whole lot of character actors in their 20s.
Yes.
And I did get a couple of things. You know, I got a day player on a television series that is no longer around, but it was called St. Elsewhere.
Can you explain what a day player is?
Okay. Yeah, sure. A day player is when literally you just have one day of work. And a lot of times it's like five lines or less. So, and you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because this is something that I learned very early on, because as much as we all want to be, you know, national and global successes.
Yes.
The reality is when you first start out, you're not.
Absolutely.
And you're going into auditions with people, especially in my situation, because I moved out to LA. So I hadn't been out there for a long time. And so you're going into these auditions with people who have just been doing this every day. They go out on auditions and all this kind of stuff. And you're getting auditions for smaller roles.
Right.
Basically, for St. Elsewhere, I had two lines. Virtually anybody could have done that part.
Right.
I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. It didn't take a lot of acting chops. It was two lines. But the director was Tim Matheson. And so I went in there, and just out of a nervous habit, I tend to try to do a little humor. And I walked in there, and he said, so are you ready? And I looked at my script. And remember, there were only two lines. And I went, well, I don't know if I've got these lines down, though. And he, you know, there's a lot of them. And he laughed. He laughed. And so I did my little audition. And sure enough, I got the part. And that is when I learned one of my most valuable lessons, which was when you're just starting out and you're auditioning for these parts that anybody can do,
mm-hmm.
remember, not only are they looking at your acting, they're looking at who you are.
Absolutely.
Are you going to be somebody easy to work with?
Right.
Are you going to be somebody that's going to be fun to have around the set? Or are you going to be somebody that's going to make the whole day a headache? You know, because when you're auditioning for these small parts like that, these are the kind of things they want to film them and get them done and check the date and move on to the next scene. So who you are, personality wise,
right,
is just as important as what your acting chops are. Like I said, especially, you know, in the beginning.
Absolutely.
When you're not getting these huge roles that the entire, you know, project revolves around your character and all that kind of stuff, that's not likely to happen in the beginning.
Yeah.
And so from the minute you go into the audition, whoever is at the desk asking people to sign in, you have to be kind, you have to be nice, you have to, because these people, next time they have an audition, you know, the person who's in charge, they go, yeah, but she was a real nightmare.
Right.
And she walked in there like she owned the place. Who is she? That kind of stuff, people file away. And so for me, you know, I got a couple of things, but in the meantime, I was also flying back to Atlanta to do shows at Upstairs at Gene and Gabe's.
Okay. So and you were bi-coastal at that point.
I was bi-coastal, and I had moved out there with my brother, and I was back here doing a show, and my brother was diagnosed with cancer. And so mm-hmm. he came home, and about 6 months later, he passed away. But all of our stuff was still out in LA. So I went back to LA and I stayed out there. And by this time, Judy, bless her heart, because I hadn't hit it big, she kind of, you know, you got that letter just saying, good luck.
Yes.
But, you know, we're, you know. And so there I was out in LA without an agent.
So now you no longer had an agent.
Exactly. And so, you know, and it was also, I was a big movie buff, and, you know, I knew everything about Hollywood in the golden age, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. When I was out there in the 80s, you know, they were sandblasting the lion off of the MGM studio. And I'm like, I don't want to see this. So I stayed out there for about 2.5 years working jobs that were not in my chosen profession.
Yes.
And for me, the right choice for me was I finally went, look, why are you out here not doing what you love, when you can go home,
right,
and work anytime you want to doing your cabaret and your one-woman shows? This is ridiculous.
So that's how you were able to base what area was going to be best for you.
At that time, yeah. But at the end of the 80s, all the cabarets went away in Atlanta, and we were doing a revival of Della's Diner.
Okay.
At a different theater in Atlanta in the late 80s. And I had been with an agency in Atlanta back when I was like 17 years old.
Okay.
And film and television. And there was, and at the end of the show, a gal that I knew was an agent. She and two other people were there, and I went up and I said, hey, how are you? Gosh, and they introduced me to the other two people. And she said, do you have a headshot? And I said, no.
Oh, wow.
You know, because you don't really need them.
Right.
What I was doing, you didn't really need a headshot and a resume and all that kind of stuff. And she said, well, get one. And so at that point, I mean, it was luck.
Which a lot of this business is.
So much of it is luck and or timing.
Right.
And so, because when I signed with that agency, that was right about the time that film in Atlanta started to pick up.
Okay.
And they were starting to do more filming in it. Not like it is now. I mean, mm-hmm. it's exploded now.
It absolutely has.
But back in the late 80s and the early 90s, it was going nuts. And it just timed out that right as cabarets were dying out in Atlanta, the film and television was picking up. And so I just started going on auditions, and I got one of my first jobs was a Hallmark Hall of Fame movie. And,
wow.
It was great because I had like 3 days on that movie. So that was big. Because in Atlanta back then, they really were only casting, again, the day player roles, because mm-hmm. they were bringing everybody else from LA, you know, all the bigger roles and everything were being cast before the production company even got to Atlanta.
So how far apart was your day player role to this role? What was the time frame between that?
Well, you know, not that long.
Okay.
Not that long. And again, it just depended on what productions were coming in and what they had already cast and what they hadn't. And I did another Hallmark Hall of Fame movie before that. And I was doing my show at the time, my live show at the time when I went and auditioned. And, you know, you have to write that. And here's another thing. Be honest.
Absolutely.
When they ask you, do you have any conflicts? Don't say no.
Right.
You need Absolutely. To be upfront. And I told them that I was doing a show, but they ended up casting me in this role. And they said, we'll fly you down because it was filming in Savannah. And they said, we'll fly you down there. Come down there, you know, that night when your show closes, we'll fly you down, we'll film, and we'll fly you back.
That's a good deal.
And so I went, well, okay, if I could still do my show, then okay. And so I did. And there were, you know, some roles were smaller and some roles were bigger. I had 3 weeks on a movie called Blue Sky,
mm-hmm.
which was filmed in 1990 or 91, but it wasn't released until 92 because Orion had gone bankrupt.
Okay.
And so,
what's Orion?
Orion was a production company.
Okay.
And a studio.
Okay.
And they had produced it and then they went bankrupt. And so there was a delay of about a year before it was finally released through another company. And it was Jessica Lange won an Oscar for Best Actress in that movie.
Wow. And, okay, and Libby.
I know, right?
Actress extraordinaire.
Powers Booth and Jessica Lange, who was as sweet as she could be. And we were all kind of afraid of her. My thing is, I don't ever speak to the stars
mm-hmm.
on a set unless they speak to me first. So, you know, so that's kind of the way we all were. But there was this one scene where we were all playing officers' wives because it took place on a military base.
Okay.
And so there was a scene where we were putting on a talent show and we were all dressed in like these Carmen Miranda outfits. And that was the last scene that we actually shot. And one of the other gals that was also from Atlanta, she said to the makeup person, she goes, Do you think it would be okay, since this is our last day, to ask Jessica Lange to take a picture with us in these crazy outfits?
Yes.
And the makeup person said, no, I wouldn't do that. Well, this gal, she was not going to have any of that. So when we finished, and they all say, okay, that's a wrap for all of the ladies, which they usually do when it's your last day of filming. They say, well, that's a wrap for so-and-so, or that's a wrap for so-and-so. And so then she went up to Jessica Lange and said, do you mind if would you take a picture with all of us? And she goes, mm-hmm. oh, absolutely. And so, and I still have that picture, and it's all of us standing with Jessica Lange, and they took the picture, and she said, oh, take another one just in case. We took another one. And then as we were all sort of walking back to our trailers, she said, I can't believe this is y'all's last day. And we had been there for 3 weeks because it was on location in Selma, Alabama.
Okay.
And we didn't work every day, but we were there for 3 weeks. And that was great because that was the longest I had ever spent on a set before. And that was really cool. But that was a wonderful, wonderful thing. And then I got a part in a movie called Something to Talk About with Julia Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also filmed in Savannah.
Okay.
And that was a lot of fun.
So a majority of your work was in Georgia.
Right. Right. Now I did, there was one that I went and auditioned for the role of Sandra Bullock's sister in a movie called Forces of Nature.
Okay.
And so then after I auditioned, my agent got the word that they had rewritten the part and it was now going to be a brother, not a sister.
Okay.
Okay, whatever.
Which happens quite a bit, that they go in a completely different direction.
Absolutely, it happens quite a bit. And then at like a month or two late, not a month, but maybe 3 or 4 weeks later, my agent gets a call and says, and my agent calls me and says, you've booked Forces of Nature. I said, how could I have done that? They changed the rules, but it's a different part. It's the part of the car rental person at the airport. You know, 4 or 5 lines.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, but it was filming in D.C.
Okay.
At Dulles Airport. And they flew me up there. Now, that doesn't happen very much because, again, this could have been done by anybody.
By anyone.
It was like 2 lines.
Right.
Something I did in the audition, whether it was my actual acting or just my personality, the director wanted to use me.
And it sounds very much like you have what Gary refers to as the industry being 20% talent, 80% getting along with people.
I think that's so true, Diamond. I think that is so true because I was absolutely blown away. And because they have to not only pay for airfare there and back, but they have to pay for a hotel room, you know, for 2 nights. And
which they could have easily gotten a local for.
They could have, because this was filming in D.C.
Right.
They could have pulled from Virginia, from Maryland, from D.C. They could have pulled anybody. And so that harkens back again to what I started off saying. And that is, you know, impression is everything.
Mm-hmm.
Acting is part of it. Like you said, Gary is your acting coach?
Yes.
Yeah. And he's absolutely right. It's everything.
So tell me about your support system when you chose to go into a performing career. Did you have a lot of support from your family? Yeah.
Well, I don't have a very big family to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother was very supportive. My mother loved to come and hear me sing. And I did have a great aunt who actually financed the first 3 or 4 months that I was out in LA.
Wow. Okay.
She would send me like $600, which back then was a lot.
Right.
Now it's nothing, but like $600 a month, you know, to help. So I did have some support, but I wouldn't say it was a huge circle just because my family is not that huge.
Right.
But I did have people who wanted, and I think people who knew me sort of knew that this was the area I was going to go into, even when I was very, very young.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my parents were thrilled when I said I didn't want to go to college. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm interested in theater, so I'm just going to flunk out if you send me. There's no point. I would rather learn from doing.
Right.
That's just the way I learn. Some people get a lot out of going to a college and majoring in theater and things like that. For me, it's just like, I just want to get out there and start working. And like I said, I think my parents, because by that time they had sent the other two kids to college. So
right.
I think their pocketbook was very high. And then I said, I'm just going to flunk out because all I care about is theater. But yeah, I would say, and it helped that I was still in my hometown.
Right. You absolutely.
Know, that's a lot of it. And I know a lot of people poo-poo that. And, you know, when I thought about moving to New York, I was like, well, look, I can do any show I want to here in Atlanta. Or I can go to New York and start waiting tables because I had no contacts in New York.
Right.
I didn't know anybody. I said, I can go there and just start waiting tables and just be a face in the crowd. Because by that time I had a little bit of name recognition in Atlanta, you know, I've been,
right.
They covered the shows that we were in and stuff like that. And I'm like, why? So there was a time for me where I just said, you know what, maybe just let the big fat star dream go. You know, maybe you're not going to be the next Liza Minnelli or Bette Midler. So just, you know, do you want to work at what you love to do?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want to pursue something that may never happen? And
that's a really good fact that you said, because I think a lot of people have what sometimes can be an unrealistic idea of the type of career they're going to have. And a lot of actors coming in forget that there are tiers to acting, in which you can be successful.
And tears.
Very many, very many of both. That, you know, and sometimes there are some people who very much just want to be a community theater actor, and that will, that's all they need in life. They don't need a lot of recognition
Right. And everybody wants, I mean, let's face it, anybody that goes into this business or the music business or anything else, when you first go in, that is everybody's dream.
Right.
I want to be nationally known. I want to be on Broadway. I want to be, you know, in an Oscar winning film.
Yeah.
You know, that's everybody's dream. And for some people, that happens. For the majority of people, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, being able to work doing what I loved was more important than being a teeny tiny fish in a huge pond.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my choice. And I'm not saying that my choice was the right choice. That was the right choice for me.
Absolutely.
And I've been very lucky. I've worked quite a bit. In the 90s, I did quite a lot of films and worked with some really wonderful people. And then I opened my own club in
2000. Oh, tell me about that. It was called Libby's, correct?
Yeah. Oddly enough, it was called Libby's.
Okay.
I know. It was a real stretch. But it was nothing I ever really wanted to do. It was nothing I ever dreamed of doing. But we were doing a benefit for a local theater in town, and they had gathered together a lot of us old dinosaurs from the cabaret days in Atlanta to do a variety show and for all of us to sing and all this kind of stuff. And they did an article about it, and the article was called No Place to Sing. And it was basically how there's still all these wonderful singers in Atlanta, but there's no more place for them to sing anymore because the cabaret thing had sort of faded out.
Right.
And after that article was printed, I got a call from somebody that had gone to high school. We weren't in the same class, but we'd gone to the same high school. And he said, well, I think this is terrible. I think you should open your own club. And I was like, oh, well, okay. He goes, no, I want to fund you opening your own club.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that part.
And so we went to lunch. And the first thing I told him was, I said, now listen, if you can't afford to live without this money, don't do this. Because cabarets are difficult. It's a lot of overhead. For us, we had a restaurant and a theater. So you've got the overhead of a restaurant, of a bar, and a theater.
Okay.
And so your nut that you have to make just to break even is huge.
Mm-hmm.
I was very clear with him. I found out later from his wife that he had gone home from that lunch and said, oh, I'll have my money back in a year. So he hadn't paid attention to anything I said. But anyway, we opened the club and it was great, but things had changed.
Mm-hmm.
People's going out habits had changed. Because in the old days, we could run a show Tuesday through Saturday with two shows on Friday and two shows on Saturday and never have to cancel a show for not having enough people. That's just the way it was in the 80s. Started out Tuesday through Saturday, but very quickly we realized, okay, we got to drop Tuesdays. Nobody's going out on Tuesdays. We got to drop Wednesdays. Nobody's going out on Wednesdays. And the only way we could get people to come in on a Thursday night was if whoever was performing that night was not also performing on the weekend. And so everything had changed. And about 2 years into it, I got cast in a theater production of Gypsy, and I played Mama Rose.
Okay.
And so my partner was left there to run the place, and he started changing it. He put, you know, a television in at the bar, and he did all this kind of stuff. And I started getting emails from our regular customers going, what's happening? What's happening? What's happening? And that's also the time that he said, I want you to buy me out or we're closing the place. Well, actually I had said to him, if you want to keep doing this, then take my name off the door because I had no interest in owning a sports bar.
Right.
So, you know, and he said, well, I want you need to buy me out. Well, I had no money.
How long had you been open by this time?
2 years.
2 years. Okay.
2 years. And and in the meantime, I'm also getting emails from some of our regular customers saying, what's going on? What's happening to the room? We had very loyal customers, loyal. And so I just sent them all an email and I said, look, we're going to have a meeting. One of them offered their house as a place where we could all get together. And I said, I'll tell you exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. And I told them exactly what was going on and that he wanted to be bought out and that I didn't have the money, so that the room was probably going to close. Five people in that meeting came forward and said, we'll give you the money to buy him out.
Wow.
Yeah, $250,000.
Wow.
So, you know, in the excitement, I was like, oh, wow, this is great. And then it sunk in. Oh, crap. I have to make this thing work. I mean, I told them, I said, chances of you getting your money back are pretty slim. And then we stayed open until 2006 when we were really, we never made money. We lost money every year. And the last year, the only way we were able to stay open was because my mother paid the rent on the club.
I love that you were realistic about it, though. You know, you didn't ever try to sell anyone a false dream. You know that you came into everything very realistic about what the possibilities business side were.
Well, you know, I couldn't handle the guilt, Diamond, honestly. You know, I couldn't handle the guilt of telling people, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be, oh, we'll make tons of money. I couldn't handle that because I've been in theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had too many times when I've shown up for work and there's been a padlock on the door.
Right.
Okay. And that's one thing I told the people that we hired to work there, the servers and the bartenders and the chefs. I said, the one thing I will never do, I will never close this place without giving you warning. Because I've had that happen to me too many times. And I'm happy to say that the year we were going to close, because the lease was running out at the end of 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, if we could just stay open until New Year's Eve 2006, I won't default on the lease.
Right.
So that's why mom said, okay. And she, bless her heart, she paid the rent for the last year that we were open. And in June, which was our sixth anniversary, because we opened in June of 2000, I gathered all of them around, the staff. And I said, listen, we're going to close. New Year's Eve is going to be our last show. And I said, mm-hmm. I understand if you want to go someplace else, you know, if you don't want to stick it out, you want to get something that's going to be more permanent. I completely understand. Not one of them left.
Speaks volumes of you.
Well, and also they made good, the waiters made good money. The tips were really good. Our crowd was very good. And especially New Year's Eve. Oh my gosh.
Right.
You know, New Year's Eve was great because we, you know, we had a dinner buffet and then we'd do the show and then we had a breakfast buffet after midnight.
Oh, wow. After midnight? That sounds like the place to be.
After we did the countdown, the buffet changed from dinner to, you know, eggs and biscuits and bacon.
What a great idea. I've never even thought about that.
We've been drinking all night.
Right. Breakfast is where it's at after midnight. Absolutely. What a great idea.
Yeah. It's like, we don't want anybody driving home on an empty stomach with a lot of liquor in them.
Right.
So anyway, so that was, you know, that was basically my life from 2000 to 2006. And so that's also when my film and television sort of went away because I didn't really have, I did a couple of things that were filming in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
I did The Blind Side and a Lifetime movie called Pregnancy Pact.
Yes.
And Queen Size.
I'm going to say Queen Size as well. I know.
My friends used to refer to it as the Libby Movie Network instead of the Lifetime Movie Network. Because Lifetime filmed a lot in Georgia there for a while. I sort of stopped doing film and television and almost completely. And then my mother became ill with dementia. And so I moved in with my mother and took care of her for the next 7 years until she passed away in 2014. And during that time as well, I had to tell my agent, you stop submitting me for stuff.
You booked out almost indefinitely.
Well, I was booked out, yeah, completely. I couldn't I couldn't leave her alone. And I'm going to be honest about it. I haven't really made an effort to get back into it.
Mm-hmm.
Right around the time I was thinking about going and getting a new headshot and all that kind of stuff, was when COVID hit. And so now I don't even have a current headshot because now I'm natural. I'm not redhead anymore.
Oh, it looks beautiful. Absolutely love that color on you.
It just is what it is. I developed an allergy to hair dye. Just had to grow it out. So it is, but I don't have any current. And now everything is so different.
Very much so.
The process is so different. In the 90s, back in the dark ages when I was doing it, the agents would get a character breakdown that listed all the characters they were looking for and described them and gave them their sides, which mm-hmm. are the pages of the scenes they're in. And the agency would then submit pictures and resumes. The casting person would call them back and say, this is who I want to see, this, and this. And you would go to a live audition. They don't do that anymore.
Now, not at all.
You have to put yourself on tape. And you have to upload it onto a casting website,
mm-hmm.
like Actors Access or 800 Casting or whatever. And you have to pay for that.
Mm-hmm. A lot of money.
Then if you don't have your own camera and have to go someplace like I did, you have to pay them to put you on tape.
Yes.
And I'm like, so now actors are at a place where they're having to pay for the privilege of auditioning.
Yes, absolutely.
Which I know is more convenient. It saves money for the production company, not having to travel to the town ahead of time to audition people and stuff. But it can put a burden on actors.
Absolutely.
But that's just the way it is now. And so it's completely different. And anyway, so.
They've also very heavily started incorporating social media into the audition process. My agents recently, literally last week, just asked me to add all my social media handles on my, actor links. And I'm why would you need that?
They want to check you out, girl.
They want to see how many followers you have. You know, they'll take someone who has a significant amount less talent than you if they have an extreme high following count.
Right.
Because they're bringing the audience.
We're in, reality TV. We have mm-hmm. people who are famous that have no talent.
Absolutely.
They're famous for being famous.
They're famous for being famous.
But again, that's why when you do get the opportunities to audition, especially when you're first starting out, personality, how do you get along with everybody? Because even if you don't get that role, they'll remember you.
Yes.
We had directors that came into Atlanta in the 90s often, and they would request actors that they had worked with before that they liked, and they would find a role for them because they liked working with them, and they knew their stuff, they hit their mark, they said their lines, and they didn't slow down the production. And that kind of stuff is invaluable, I think.
Okay, let me ask you one last question.
Okay.
If you were a fresh 18-year-old off the bus from Kansas mm-hmm. going into acting for the first time, what would you have done differently than you did the first time coming into the business?
Well, when you say coming off the bus from Kansas, do you mean you've gone to LA as an 18-year-old?
Anywhere, where you're just coming into this.
The first thing I would say, and what my agents used to tell new actors is, before you start shooting for the stars, build a resume.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's just local productions. Even if, and of course, nowadays, it can be, anybody in the world can make an independent movie.
Right.
I guess you could do TikTok stuff. You could do whatever. But it's never a good idea to show up in New York or LA with nothing.
Or Atlanta now. Atlanta is a huge market.
Because Atlanta now is just
huge market.
It's Soho, Southern Hollywood, and and so if that's the first, that's the first thing. Because I also here's the thing. I also worked in an agent's office.
Okay. Ooh, tell us about that.
I worked in the print department, but the agency did film and television and industrial and credit work. So it was in there in the 90s when I was still auditioning and still doing stuff, but I was working in the agent's office. And actors, I think every actor should have to work in an agent's office for 6 months.
Okay.
To learn, especially if you're not in LA or New York and you're not a big fat star. Agents don't have a lot of power with production companies. So when you, actors tend to blame their agents when they don't get a part or when they don't get the pay they thought they were going to get. Now in Atlanta, when I was doing film and television, I was a member of SAG and AFTRA, but the local office didn't have a whole lot of power. And Georgia is a right to work state, meaning you have a right to work as a non-union member in a union production.
Okay.
That's what right to work state means. And so, you know, the SAG-AFTRA office in Atlanta was sort of caught between a rock and a hard place because they were trying to get more producers, more local producers that were producing commercials and producing industrials and stuff, to be SAG signatory, meaning they signed on with the union and they would hire, they would abide by union rules. And
okay.
they would pay union rates for everything. And so in that situation, they had to cut a lot of deals that the agent had no control over. The agent would get a project. This happened to an agent in the office where I worked. She had booked a big commercial for four or five talent at that agency. And they were supposed to film on Thursday and Friday. But then she got a notation that the shoot had been moved to the weekend.
Okay.
And so she's contacting the producer and saying, well, now the rate is going to go up for the actors because you're filming on a weekend. Mm-hmm. And she got a call from the union saying, nope, the rate's going to stay the same. But the actors got mad at the agent.
Of course.
For not getting them the weekend rate. And so it's those kinds of things. And I was putting people on tape. I was responsible for putting people on tape when they were auditioning for a film or whatever. You know who I put on tape for the very first time?
Who?
For his audition with Disney?
Who?
Kenan Thompson.
No way.
Kenan Thompson, I think he was about 13 years old.
Wow, I didn't know that.
His first audition for Disney, yeah, that he got and just, you know, blew up from there. From there, went to Nickelodeon and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I put him on tape. I did. That's my claim to fame.
Okay, Libby.
And I'll tell you the best piece of acting advice I ever got for doing film, for doing camera, that I'd never thought of before, but it made perfect sense. And I'm sure your acting, I'm sure Gary, is that his name? I'm sure Gary has said this numerous times. But the best advice I got for camera was, if you think it, we will see it.
Yes, he absolutely has said that.
And especially if you come from a theater background.
Yes.
Where you're used to having to, you know, emote
the overly expressive.
Exactly. And you have to, you know, you don't have, because the camera may be 15 feet away from you.
Right.
But the frame is here.
Mm-hmm.
And so you think you have to play to the camera, which is way over there, but actually it's all right here. And that's when that came in handy for me. It's like, okay, even though the camera's not near you, the frame is. And any facial expression, it could be too much.
Right.
And that was That was the best piece of advice I ever.
That's great advice and something for us to definitely keep in mind.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, this was awesome, Libby. Thank you so much for being on the Broke Actor podcast. Where can people find you?
I'm on Facebook and I'm on Instagram and I'm on Twitter. And for the last almost 2 years, every Thursday night at 7:30 p.m. Eastern time.
Okay.
I'm doing a something that we've come to call Living Room Cabaret. I do a 30-minute show with my musical director, Robert Strickland, because we were supposed to open a show.
Right.
On August 16th, 2020.
Right.
And it got canceled. And so I said, hey, Robert, what do you think about doing a, you know, like a one-off, which is what I thought it was going to be, the night our show was supposed to open. And we'll just do some of the songs that we were going to do in the show. And he was like, great, I'm in. So we went. And now this coming Thursday will be number 78.
Wow.
Is that right?
That's a commitment.
It'll be number 79.
79.
We just did 78 last night.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it's the place to be, guys. I'm telling you, that Thursday night concert is the place to be. The comments section is jumping at all times.
If you like old fart music, yeah.
And she sometimes takes requests, guys. Every now and then.
I do take requests.
She takes requests.
I'm 60, almost 67. So, you know, there's not a whole lot of, current stuff happening, especially when all you have is a piano and you don't have all the instruments behind you. So,
well, as long as you play Diana Ross, I'm always for it.
We have done some.
You have.
You know, 60s and 70s, 60s music. And we've done some current stuff. I've done a couple of Adele, you know, when I dare to do Adele. But most of it is standards or 60s, 70s music, Motown, you know. That kind of stuff, and some Broadway, but not a lot. But you know, just I'm just giving fair warning.
Yes,
this is not it's literally in this room where I am right now. I don't know if you can see it, but there's Robert's keyboard. This is my living room, and this is literally where we do the living room cabaret.
Well, take it from me, guys, it's something you don't want to miss. You should check it out at least once.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm a fan.
I appreciate it.
I am a super fan of yours.
Stop it.
We will list all of Libby's social media handles where you can find them on this video. And it was such a pleasure, Libby.
Oh, it was so great.
Love to have you back in the future.
Well, you know, I can talk. So,
Can't we all? You're an actor. Of course you can.
Right. Exactly. You know, just ask me a question and then I'll talk for 30 minutes. So, okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, honey. Good to see you.
You too.